There'll be days like this when there's no one complaining. There'll be days like this. Everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'll be days like this.
This is Matt Hoyes sitting in for Dave Congleton on the Dave Congleton Show, 920 AM and 96.5 FM, News Talk KVEC. We've got on the line Dan Walters, the Dean of California Political Reporters, been covering the State House up there since Jerry Brown was governor the first time. Dan, it's great to have you on.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Well, I brought you on so we could kind of talk about what's happening nowadays in the Capitol, and you know, got a new administration up there with the Gavin Newsom. Let's start out with the bullet train. It's my understanding that, I mean, he made a big announcement that he was canceling it, and then it seems like it's not quite canceled. It's on life support. Tell us about that.
Well, I never said he was canceling exactly. He implied that once the section in the San Joaquin Valley is finished and it's under construction now, that's kind of it, because there's no money and so forth. It was a little bit fuzzy, and then when it got reported in the media, this is what he said. Then he kind of started backing off of it and said, well, no, we're really not abandoning the thing, because I think they realized that if they did that, then it's possible they would lose the federal funds that the government has already given them to build the section of San Joaquin Valley, because that was supposed to be part of a larger project.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right on cue, Donald Trump rolls in and says, we want our money back. And then it became a formal thing from the agency, the federal agency that gave them the $3.5 billion in the first place. They say, well, you've already spent $2.5 billion. We want that back, and we're not going to give you the other 900 some odd million. And now they're going to fight over it. And in a way, Donald Trump kind of rescued the governor, who had kind of flubbed up this thing. It was a kind of a botch sort of a comment, and then Trump comes along and says, we want our money back, and so then it gave Newsom a chance to say, well, this is all Trump's fault. He's trying to take our money from us, which may or may not be true. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of a bad episode all the way around.
But
in the meanwhile, what's really happening is that they are continuing to build the section from about Chowchilla down to a orchard near Shafter. That's where it ends, an orchard near Shafter, short of Bakersfield.
Okay.
And what they're saying, that's not going to be done for at least 4 more years.
From Chowchilla to an orchard near Shafter.
And if they don't get it done by 2022, the feds can get their money back anyway, because that's in the contract.
So the current segment is Chowchilla to an orchard near Shafter.
Shafter.
And
yeah, that's about where it goes to.
Have they built any stations?
People say it's Chowchilla, but it's somewhere in between that. What's that?
Have they built any stations? Or are we just talking track?
I don't think they've built any stations. Most of the construction has been going on right in Fresno itself. They're building a bridge. A viaduct over the San Joaquin River between Madera and Fresno, and they've cleared out a lot of land on the between Highway 99 and downtown Fresno to do all of this. So they're working there, but that's about as far as it's actually gotten in terms of actual construction.
Let's take a step back and just remind our listeners kind of what was originally promised.
The legislature, at the behest of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was then governor, put a measure on the ballot in 2008 for $9.95 billion, $9 billion of which was to be the state's share of a bullet train project that was supposed to cost, the number got a little fuzzy about that point. Originally it was supposed to be $33 billion, and then it got up to $40 billion, but something in that range. And then the other $950 million were to be spent on kind of feeder lines. In other words, commuter rail to feed into this system. And then supposedly this was going to build a system that would take passengers from downtown San Francisco to downtown Los Angeles in 2 hours and 40 minutes. And then eventually it was to be extended down south to Orange County and San Diego. And eventually it was to have another branch that went up to Sacramento. That was the plan.
Okay.
It got hung up in lawsuits and the cost overruns, and cost estimates went up to as high as $100 billion and then came back down to about $77 billion. And the project got changed around several times. The route of the project got changed around several times. And ultimately, all they had was enough money from the bond issue and this federal grant to build this kind of starter line in the San Joaquin Valley. But that was just for track and stations. That's not rolling stock. It's not the trains themselves. And it's not electrification. It's just simply some track and a couple of stations. And that's what's going on right now. And in theory, if nothing else is ever built, this supposedly this section that they're building in the San Joaquin Valley could be folded into the Amtrak line and be used for Amtrak if it doesn't become part of a high-speed rail system. Once that's built, if in fact it ever is built, then in theory, the next phase would be to connect Chowchilla or somewhere in that vicinity. Governor Newsom talks about extending up to Merced and down to Bakersfield. Something in that vicinity going up the Pacheco Pass and then under the Pacheco Pass in a tunnel and taking the train to the area south of San Jose. And in theory, then, another rail line, a commuter rail line, would connect up, coming down from San Francisco, would connect up there. And once that was all done, if it ever gets done, which is unlikely, then you would actually be able to ride a train from downtown San Francisco to Bakersfield. That's what through the Silicon Valley and over the under the Pacheco Pass and down the valley. But the next phase, this phase to connect up to the Silicon Valley, would cost at least $20 billion. And
is that just the track, or is that,
and they don't have the money,
getting the land too?
Money isn't there. So
okay. So, but Newsom's promised that they're going to continue. I guess my next question is, where are they getting the money to connect up? You know, to do what Newsom has promised, which is getting it as far as Merced, because it doesn't sound like the money for that yet exists or has been budgeted.
No, it doesn't, and that's very fuzzy as to where that money would come from. In addition to the bond issue, in addition to this federal grant, the bullet train project gets 1/4 of all the revenue from the state's sale of carbon dioxide emission allowances, the cap and trade program,
mm-hmm.
and that generates maybe $500 million to $1 billion a year for high speed rail.
Okay.
You can't predict those auction results what they're going to be, but that's a pretty good number. Unfortunately for them, it's not enough to actually do the big next extension of the project over to the Silicon Valley. It might be enough to extend the line to Merced and to Bakersfield, but it's pretty evident that the people in Bakersfield don't want it in Bakersfield, which is one reason why it's stopping at a orchard near Shafter, because they cannot do a deal with the people in Bakersfield for this train as of yet. Now, if it were to be built southward, it would go into Bakersfield and then down over the Tehachapi Mountains, or perhaps through the Tehachapi Mountains, into the Palmdale, mm-hmm. in the Antelope Valley, and then tunnel through the mountains that lie between Palmdale and the San Fernando Valley area of Los Angeles, and that would be, they have to tunnel through those mountains to get into the Los Angeles Basin.
Tunneling isn't cheap.
That would be out there in Never Never Land somewhere if they would ever get to that point. Now, remember, this whole thing was supposed to be done by about 2025 or something. And it's unlikely that even the section in the San Joaquin Valley will be done on time. Now, that grant from the federal government was contingent on them finishing the San Joaquin Valley section by 2017. Obviously, that's 2 years ago.
Right.
It's not been finished. So the Obama administration gave them a say, okay, we'll give you five more years to 2022. But the state's auditor just recently audited the books of the high-speed rail, and their performance has said they would have to double up their construction activity to make by 2022. And that's unlikely to occur, certainly. And the current estimate is that that line in the San Joaquin Valley may not even be open until somewhere in the late 20s.
Okay. We're talking with Dan Walters of CalMatters.org here on the Dave Congleton Show. We'll be right back. If you're interested in asking Dan a question about anything having to do with Sacramento politics, bullet train, this guy knows more than anybody except maybe Willie Brown. So give us a call, 805-543-8830, 1-800-549-5832. We'll be right back with Dan Walters on the Dave Congleton Show, 920 AM and 96.5 FM. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show on 920 AM and 96.5 FM. This is Matt Hoy in for Dave. We are talking with Dan Walters of CalMatters.org, formerly of the Sacramento Bee for many, many years, and has been in the newspaper business for longer than I've been alive. And I'm not a young buck. So,
unfortunately, that's probably true.
Dan, have any studies been done on kind of what the ridership would be if they finish this Merced to Bakersfield thing? How many people are going to be on that train on the average day?
Merced, no, not that section. No, because they've done some ridership projections for the whole thing, for sections that where you could actually envision, rate-paying customers, like from San Francisco to Fresno or something like mm-hmm. that. But no, nobody figured out how many people would really want to ride from Merced to Bakersfield on a given day. And I think the answer is probably not very many.
Yeah, that would be my guess, too. And this isn't high speed either.
I don't think anybody would dispute that. Look, they're trying to rescue something that may be unrescuable. It's very difficult for politicians to give up and say, hey, we blew it. We made a mistake. We shouldn't be doing what we're doing. Have you ever heard a politician say that? No.
I haven't, but you've been around longer than I have.
It's ingrained in them not to ever admit some error of judgment. And so there's always an excuse, or you keep throwing money at something, hoping that it'll get to a point where you can claim a success or something. But it's very rare, almost non-existent, for somebody to say, hey, this sounded good at the time, but it turned out to be a bad idea. Now, you and I, in our daily lives, will sometimes do that. We'll mm-hmm. say we invested some money in the stock market, and it doesn't work out, and you say, well, okay, I'll sell those shares and take my loss and be done with it. But you don't see that in politics, because that's considered to be, if you admit that you've made a mistake, then you're basically saying, I shouldn't be in this office, and you never want to say that. So the stakes are covered up, they're ignored, they are given more money to try to make something happen that can't happen. I mean, that's just the typical of officialdom, and this bullet train is as good an example of it as any other. There are many other examples, obviously, but this is a good example.
We've got a call from George in Santa Margarita. You're on the line with Dan Walters.
Hello, Dan, and I believe you'd be the most appropriate person to ask this question to. There are a lot of allegations that have been made that I've heard, and I'd love to get your answer. Is it true that the Feinstein family is raking in millions of dollars on this project?
I'm having a hard time understanding you. Are you talking about Feinstein's family?
Is it true that the Feinstein family here in California is raking in millions of dollars on this project, whether it works or not?
I don't think it's true, but I understand that Dianne Feinstein's husband is a very wealthy investor in a whole bunch of different companies. And it would not surprise me if he had some financial interest in one of the companies with holding the contracts, or some of the contracts on this thing. But that said, she has never been a particularly big advocate of this project. And so, you know, I've heard this allegation myself, and there might be a tiny little grain of truth into it. But let's look at it this way. One of the her husband's name is Richard Bloom. One of Richard Bloom's many investments is the the big commercial real estate Coldwell banker Richard Ellis. Have you seen those? CBRE, right? You've seen those signs on commercial property all around Helangong? Well,
yes, I have.
They handle commercial real estate, and it's possible that they've handled commercial real estate transactions or leases, it's mostly leases, for some federal agency. Now, is that a conflict of interest for Dianne Feinstein? You know, I don't see a big thing there, and I'll tell you why. Dianne Feinstein was independently wealthy before she ever married Richard Bloom. And he was wealthy. He's got more money than God. And there's no real motivation there for them to be trying to finagle stuff. And there's a lot of motivation for them not to, you know, to kind of keep clean on these things, because why? They don't want to go to their graves thinking they're a crook. So I've heard this for a long time. Nobody's ever come up with any evidence that it's any kind of significant factor. And until I see some evidence that it is, I'm going to say, no, it's probably not true, or it's 99% not true.
Thanks for the call, George. We're on the line with Dan Walters, Dean of California Political Reporters. We've got a hard break coming up, but Dan, when you've got, I think when we come back, we'll take more calls. Also like to talk with you about this recent pension judgment and kind of what that means for the California budget going forward. This is the Dave Conklin Show. Matt Hoy sitting in for Dave. This you're listening on 920 AM and 96.5 FM. This is Matt Hoy sitting in for Dave Conklin on the Dave Conklin Show. We've got Dan Walters, Dean of California Political Reporters, on the line with us. If you have got a question about California politics, now's your chance. This guy knows more than everyone else combined. So give us a call, 805-543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. Dan, where can people find your writing nowadays, now that you're no longer with the Sacramento Bee?
CalMatters.org, CalMatters.org. I write a column 4 days a week, and it's posted there on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And also, our material, all of our material, is distributed free of charge to about 150 other news outlets around the state, newspapers, radio stations, whatnot. So my column runs quite frequently in daily newspapers around the state as well.
Okay. So I was reading on CalMatters an article by one of your colleagues, Judy Lynn, about this big court case on pensions. Can you kind of tell us what happened and what's going on with, you know, the pension issue here in California? Because I know that a lot of people are worried about, you know, having enough money to pay public employees when they retire, or at least what's been promised.
Yeah, my column on that decision will be posted tomorrow morning. As everybody should know, if they don't know, the major public pension systems of California, particularly California Public Employees Retirement System and the California State Teachers Retirement System, both have huge, tens of hundreds of billions of dollars of unfunded liabilities. That means those are like debts. In other words, they're lacking enough money to pay all the promises of pensions that have been made, even if one assumes that they're going to earn on their investments the rate that they think they're going to earn, which is about 7% a year. They're still way behind. In fact, CalPERS is only about two-thirds funded, and the teachers system is a little bit better off, but basically both of them are don't have nearly enough money. So, and the reason for it primarily is that both of them lost a tremendous amount of money in the recession, the Great Recession, a decade ago. CalPERS case about $100 billion, and they've never been able to recover from that. So what they're doing is ramping up the mandatory contributions from public employers, from the state itself, and from local governments and school districts that are members of their organization. And that's most cities and most counties and most special districts. Some larger cities, counties, and special districts have their own separate retirement systems, but most participate in CalPERS. And so these mandatory payments are getting wrapped up very rapidly to try to save these systems from going, they can't really go bankrupt, but to become insolvent. And they're very worried that if they get another economic downturn, they will be pushed past the point of no return. Anyway, so that's the background, that's the financial background. And why are they, it's not just the recession losses. They also have more and more people claiming pensions because the baby boomer generation is getting old and claiming their pensions. And non-teacher pension benefits were greatly increased about 20 years ago, and that is also having effect. So about 7 years ago, right after Jerry Brown became governor for the second time, he and the legislature passed a very modest pension reform plan to create lower benefits for new employees hired after 2012, and a bunch of other changes in the plan. One of those changes has to do with what's called airtime, which you've probably never heard of. Airtime allowed public employees to buy service credits. Let's say they have 10 years in service and they want to retire. They could buy up to 5 more years of credit and then retire with a pension based on 15 years of service rather than 10 years.
How would they do that? Like a cash payment to the state or something?
Well, usually it's in the form of a time payment plan. And in theory, it pays the full cost of that extra service credit, but in fact, as audits have shown, it doesn't. In other words, you pay in and you get a lot back more than you pay in
right. Under
those systems. So that's called airtime. Well, one of the provisions of this pension reform eliminated airtime, no more airtime.
Mm-hmm.
And some firefighters sued the state saying that is a contractual right that they had to buy airtime. Because California has, this is going to get more complicated, believe me, because California operates under what's called the California Rule, based on a 1955 state Supreme Court decision that says once you are in a system and the benefits are in that system at that time that you are hired, those benefits can never be reduced. And so it's called the California Rule. Well, the firefighters said this airtime was covered by the California Rule, that they had a right to buy this airtime, and you can't take it away from them because of the airtime, because of the California Rule. So this thing went up through the courts, and it wound up in the state Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled yesterday that airtime is not a right vested under the California rule, and therefore the legislature and the governor could eliminate airtime. And because they decided that it was not covered by the California rule, they didn't have to get to the next issue, which is the California rule really valid? Because some of the lower courts have said California rule is a fiction. It doesn't really exist in law. Hmm. So they didn't get to that point, which is the biggie. That's the biggie. The airtime thing is important, but the other thing, California rule, is the biggie. Now, there are a couple of other lawsuits pending before the Supreme Court, also filed by unions against other provisions of the pension reform, and the court could potentially get to the issue of of the California rule in one of these other cases. The California rule is important because were it to be overturned, it would allow these public employers, cities, counties, et cetera, to negotiate with their unions on reducing benefits for future work. They might say something like, okay, you're getting it everything you deserve up to this point, but going forward, instead of getting X pension, you're going to get a lower pension. Under the California rule, you can't do that. If the California rule is abolished, it's possible to do it. That would then reduce the cost of the pensions and presumably reduce some of the burden on taxpayers to pay these rapidly rising payments. Now, how big are these payments? Typically, cities and counties are now paying 50 cents on every dollar of payroll for police and fire personnel. Every dollar they earn in pay, another 50 cents has to go to the pension fund. Mm-hmm. For non-safety, non-police, non-fire personnel, it's down around 25 or 30 cents. But all these rates are also going up pretty dramatically. It's expected that the police and fire pensions are going to get up to 75% of payroll. Every dollar you pay a policeman in salary, you'd have to put another 75 cents into the pension fund. And it could, for non-police, non-fire personnel, they could get up to 40 or 50 cents per thing. These are very, very big numbers when you apply them to millions of public employees in California. So these bills have been going up very rapidly on these employers. Now, how have they handled it? Some of them have tried to negotiate with their unions on reducing their costs. You may not have noticed, but hundreds of cities and counties, mostly cities, put tax measures on the ballot in the last two election cycles, in 2016 and 2018. Virtually all of that money collected on those new sales taxes will go to pensions, even though when they asked the voters to approve these tax increases, they didn't tell them it was going for pensions, because that would be considered they were worried that the voters wouldn't vote for it if they said this was a pension.
Right,
so they
right.
would just say, this is to enhance police and fire services. Well, it's really to enhance police and fire pensions, not services. But there was a little bit of little bit of fudging going on there. A lot of fudging, I should say. So that's the situation, and it's all very much up in the air. But since the California rule survived this week's Supreme Court decision, nobody knows what's going to happen. And if the California rule remains in effect under the current trajectory that the pension systems are on now, is that they're going to have to force these employers, cities and counties and so forth, to cough up tens of billions of dollars more over the next, probably about the next 10 years, to keep those funds solvent. Now, it's possible that despite that, they could become insolvent if we get another serious recession, which would mean that they'd lose money on their investments again, and they would be in the soup again.
We've got a caller on the line for Dan. Dan, Craig, who do we have?
We got Michael up in Paso.
Mike, what do you got for us? That's not going to work. Michael's cutting in and out. Try calling back on a landline, Michael. Dan, I looked at some of that reporting yesterday. I realized that CalSTRS, which is the teachers, is in a little better shape than CalPERS. But there was a line in there in Judy Lynn's reporting yesterday that really jumped down at me, and you've kind of covered it to a certain extent. It says, schools are a prime example. Despite billions more in state funding, much of the growth in education spending has been diverted to pensions. The State Department of Finance and the Legislative Analyst's Office say schools may need to use well over half of all new money just to cover their growing pension obligations. So, have we got Mike back?
Yeah, we got him back.
Okay, let's try this again.
All right, you're on the air, Mike.
Thank you, Dan. Quick question for you. Maybe you can shed some light on your perspective of how SB 54 was pushed through, and what your how this got hatched by apparently Kevin DeLeon and Javier Becerra, and getting this done. And it's got a lot of people upset. Obviously, me being one of them. What's your perspective of how that all happened? What the future holds for that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Dan, if you can answer that really quickly, briefly, and then we got a break.
Is a so-called sanctuary bill for California having to do with non-cooperation with federal immigration authorities when it comes to undocumented immigrants. It was an easy thing to do in this legislature. It's a very liberal legislature, and particularly so in relation to Donald Trump and his crackdown on illegal immigration. It's one of those resistance things. You know, California has sued the federal government, I think, 47 times as of today on various aspects of things that the Trump administration wanted to do. And the politicians at the top of the heap in California fancy themselves the leader of the resistance to Donald Trump. So getting that passed was a pretty easy thing. I mean, it echoes the sentiments found in the Capitol, but I think it pretty much also echoes the sentiments found in California's voters. I mean, there's not a great deal of support overall among California voters for cracking down on illegal immigration the way the Trump administration wants to do it. There's a lot of sympathy for the about 2 million undocumented immigrants who live in California. And so it was not like a sneak attack or anything. I think it pretty much reflected the prevailing views in the legislature and the prevailing views in the public as a whole.
This is Matt Hoy.
You may not like it. You may not like it, but it probably was not something that had to be snuck through the process at all.
This is Matt Hoy on the Dave Congleton Show, 920 AM, 96.5 FM. We've got Dan Walters on here for one more segment. Hoy, sitting in for Dave Congleton on the Dave Congleton Show, KVEC News Talk, 920 AM, 96.5 FM. We're talking to Dan Walters, the Dean of California Political Reporting. Dan, you mentioned before we went to break that the California state up there in the State House that they have filed 47 lawsuits against the federal government and things that Donald Trump's trying to do. How many of those lawsuits, I guess the question is, are they serious about? How many of those are something that they can win, and how many of them are kind of, you know, just virtue signaling to their base?
I think that most of them are virtue signaling to their base. Some of them are clearly unwinnable. Some of them, they might win some parts of them. None of them has been resolved finally, as far as I know. The best they've gotten so far is a few little preliminary, you know, orders and that sort of thing. It's mostly just to tell the world that California is kind of a nation unto itself that's resisting the evil empire in Washington. I mean, that's what this is all. This is like Star Wars, you know? The evil empire versus the good guys, that sort of thing. A lot of this is just that. And it will take years, long probably after Donald Trump has gone from the White House, for a lot of these things to be resolved. But, you know, I'm not saying they're insincere. I'm just saying that they're kind of trying to pump up the image of resistance to the Trump administration and to Congress, by the way, the Republican Congress, until recently Republican Congress, I should say, as well.
What? So they're not really serious about getting judgments on these things. It's what sorts of ones are they serious about? Which ones do they want something to happen sooner rather than later on?
Oh, I think the things involving the big hot button issues like immigration and various parts of the immigration conflict. They'd love to win all of them, of course, but that's not probably going to be in the cards. It's not that they're not sincere about wanting to oppose Trump, but it's just a way of dramatizing their opposition to Trump and Trumpism and Republicans and so forth. It's basically a new version of the game that Texas played during the Obama administration, where they were forever suing the Obama administration because they didn't like what he was doing. So it's not a new wrinkle. It's just one of those ways in which, underlying the whole thing are two sections of the U.S. Constitution that are somewhat in conflict with one another. One of them says something like, all powers not reserved for Congress and the federal government can be exercised by the state.
Yeah, 10th Amendment.
States' Rights Clause. And the other one says that the federal government is supreme.
Right.
So there's inherent conflict in those two sections of the Constitution, and all of these lawsuits, to one degree or another, deal with that conflict. Can the federal government tell California what to do? And the answer, whether it's the bullet train or anything else, is, well, maybe it can and maybe it can't. And that's why we're going to court. or we're trying to delay until Donald Trump is gone or something like that.
Yeah.
And hope for another president will be more amenable to California and what we want to do. And there are a lot of those conflicts. There's a huge one over auto emission rules, smog rules having to do with cars, and a huge conflict over that. That's probably going to wind up in the courts somehow because they can't. They've been negotiating kind of more or less without ever being able to make a deal. So all of these conflicts that are essentially political conflicts are being transformed into legal conflicts. But they're really political conflicts masquerading as legal conflicts. And that's true in when Texas was suing Obama's people all the time, and it's true in California suing Trump all the time. It's just a way of finding a venue to fight in.
How do you think we've got a new governor now for the first time in 8 years. Jerry Brown been around a long time. Gavin Newsom served as his lieutenant governor. What and how is Gavin Newsom administration going to look different than Jerry Brown? They're both Democrats. They're both liberal. But I sense that there are some pretty big differences there still.
Oh, yeah, there's big differences of style and substance. But Gavin Newsom is kind of Jerry Brown's uncle. You have to know the family relationships. Basically, the Newsom and the Brown families have been intertwined for generations, along with the Pelosi family and the Getty family. I mean, I wrote a whole column about it not too long ago. So Gavin Newsom's kind of Jerry Brown's nephew. And so like all nephews of new generations, they want to set themselves apart from their elders, right? That's just human nature. So a lot of it's that going on. He tweets about as much as Donald Trump does, as Newsom does. Hardly anything goes by that he doesn't tweet about, just as hardly anything goes by that Trump doesn't tweet about. Gavin Newsom was trying to make a name for himself. He was trying to become the leader of the resistance against the evil empire in his mind. And then, so there's that. So he's much more out there jabbering and tweeting and doing all these.
Does he have presidential aspirations?
Jerry Brown was. He's also appears to be somewhat more liberal than Jerry on financial stuff, although that's going to be a play itself out. Hey, all governors are different from their predecessors. Jerry Brown was different from Ronald Reagan. George McMaster was different from Jerry Brown. Pete Wilson was different from George the Amazing. Gray Davis was different than Pete Wilson. Arnold Schwarzenegger was different than Gray Davis. And Jerry Brown is different than Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Dan,
they,
Dan,
they
are
all
there?
Bring their
Dan.
Differences to the table.
Dan, does Gavin Newsom have any presidential aspirations?
Of course he does. It's not going to be in 2020. In fact, one could argue that the best thing could happen to Gavin Newsom politically was if he were Donald Trump to win re-election in 2020, because it would give him 4 more years of being the anti-Trump, number one, and the presidency would open in 2024,
Dan,
which would be perfect timing for Gavin Newsom.
Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Trump in 2020.
Dan, thanks for joining us today. This, you've been listening to the Dave Conklin Show, News Talk 920 AM, 96.5 FM. We will be right back after the news and weather.